versus evolution, just some of the problems. Actually, this page should be titled The Problems of Evolution. And this is something we can't get too deep into it. This is something you could have a whole course on, creation science. And so basically, we're just going to bring up six different problems with evolution. And the sixth problem is the many unproven assumptions of evolution. We're going to list those as well. So we're talking about how we're coming out of a secular humanistic worldview, where the rejection of God, some of the problems with that, and probably most people who are atheists believe that two strongest evidences for atheism are, number one, the problem of evil. We talked about that last week. And number two, they believe that science proves their atheism, when in reality that's about as far from the truth as you can get. In fact, Michael Behe argues, he's a microbiologist, and he argues that most leading scientists that he knows, though they're evolutionists, a good portion of them, they believe in the existence of God, some type of God. So, the only ones we hear about are the militantly anti-God scientific thinkers. But the first problem with evolution is that modern science was founded by Christians. Modern science was founded by Christians. I think it's kind of interesting, and it should cause us to wonder how it could be the case if science promotes atheism or proves atheism so clearly, then why don't we find it that, atheists were the guys that founded modern science? But instead it's the exact opposite. They were Christians, and the reason for this was because they believed that we were created by a rational God in His image, so that we had the ability to reason, and that this God created the universe and designed it in an orderly way, so that through our God-given reason, we could really find out truth about the universe in which we live. So Christianity got modern science jump-started. So guys like, Blaise Pascal and Isaac Newton and Galileo, and the list goes on and on, Johannes Kepler, just about every branch of modern science was founded by a Bible-believing Christian. And I don't think that would be the case if Christianity is really scientifically bankrupt. Number two, second problem for evolution is the beginning of the universe. We talked about this already, how the Big Bang model and the second law of thermodynamics, energy deterioration, they both show that the universe had a beginning. And atheistic evolution cannot explain. If atheistic evolution, it attempts to explain everything that occurs by a natural cause, so then what do you do when you find out that all of nature had a beginning? All of nature needs a cause. So you can't say, well, there was some natural cause for the beginning of nature. No, because all the natural causes would be in nature. So if all of nature needed a cause, by definition, nature, the universe, had to have a supernatural cause. Another problem for evolution is first life. Evolution teaches spontaneous generation, that life spontaneously arose from non-life. Okay? But what we are now finding is that the specified complexity or the highly complex information found in the genetic code of a single-celled animal, the most simplest form of life, is much more complex than what you would find in non-living things. So, basically, just to get the blueprint for life, you've got to take such a quantum leap forward, and things left to themselves, natural things left to themselves without intelligent intervention, will go from a state of order to disorder and not the other way around. And so here you have an increase in complexity, an increase in information in the DNA, and you know, you just can't get that by chance. Intelligent intervention is needed. You know, the ancient Greeks, they took like a little box and they threw dirty clothes in there, they threw trash in there, they threw rotting food in there, and then they left it alone for a couple of days and they came back and lo and behold, there's all flies and rats in there. And so that the ancient Greeks who believed in spontaneous generation, the ancient Greeks who were basically evolutionists, really believed that from garbage, you know, rats were evolving and things like that. Now, of course, by the time Louis Pasteur, who was a Christian, got on the scene, he did a more controlled experiment and proved that if you, you know, do this in an airtight situation where no living things could get at it, and you have non-living material, you're not going to get any living things from that. It just doesn't happen spontaneously. Also, problem number four, complex life forms. Now with the first life, the single-celled animal, okay, you've got enough genetic information to fill an entire library, okay? With complex life forms like a human brain, the amount of complexity again takes a quantum leap forward. And so again, you can't go from highly complex information to, you know, thousands upon thousands of times as complex of information as that. You just can't make that jump without intelligent intervention. You know, Norman Geisler uses the illustration that, you know, if you walked in the room and you saw confetti and it's, you know, spelt out Jesus saves on the floor, okay, you wouldn't think, oh, okay, somebody just threw confetti up in the air and it just landed, spelled out Jesus saves. You figure somebody just got down on the floor and spelled it out themselves. And it just doesn't happen by chance, just those two small words, Jesus saves. Now the evolutionist says, well, given enough time, it could happen by chance. So then Geisler would say, well, then go up in a helicopter and drop the confetti. The more time you get, the more random it's going to be. So even with more time, without intelligent intervention, you're still not going to go from a state of disorder to order. And in the fossil record, this is still part of number four. Well, actually, let's save it for number five. Number five, there's no transitional forms found in the fossil record. Transitional form, everybody, there are, you know, part of the problem is what evolutionists call a species, and I don't know if I spelled it right, and what the Bible calls a kind, okay? One thing we have to keep in mind that you know, when the evolutionists say, well, this species evolved into this other species, we don't automatically have to say, no, that's not true. I believe in the Bible, and therefore it couldn't happen. Because sometimes what the scientists defined as a species the Bible would not define as a different kind. Okay, like for instance, the lion and the tiger. Now they mate them together, and they reproduce. There's the liger is when the father is the lion, and it's they're bigger than lions or tigers, and the tiglon is when the tiger is the father. And they tend to be smaller. They tend to be more dwarf. But it's amazing how big these ligers can get. The biggest one on earth that they have is if they stand them up, and then they get a guy to stand on a picnic table and they put his paws on it from his head, the bottom of its feet is 11 feet high. It's the largest one and weighs over 1,000 pounds. I think there's one that's 10 feet high. The one I saw on TV was 10 feet high and weighs 900 pounds. And just like this high off the ground. They look like tigers, but they're kind of an off-white color, and you can barely make out the stripes. But there's an example where, since they can reproduce, the Bible would put both the lion and the tiger in the same kind. So any of the big cats that could reproduce with one another, the Bible would put them in that, you know, that category. So you know, keeping that in mind, when you come to like the major groups, okay, and I don't, you know, we're talking like if when we're going from like reptiles to birds, okay, things of that sort, jumps of that sort, then obviously, you know, when you're making a jump that big, obviously the Bible would say no, you know, that didn't occur. But when you're looking for transitional forms between reptiles and birds, between apes and men, there is absolutely no evidence for this whatsoever. So you won't find in the fossil record something with half an arm and, you know, half a wing, or half a fin and half an arm. Fossils appear suddenly and fully developed, okay? So you don't have, so you have these huge gaps, okay? And because Colin Patterson from the British Museum, he has the world's largest display of fossils in his museum, he openly acknowledges that there are no unquestioned transitional forms in this sense, that he has no record of that whatsoever. And he believes, Colin Patterson believes in gradual evolution, but he acknowledges that there's no evidence of a fossil of a transitional form. He hopes to find one someday. Well, this has caused Stephen Jay Gould, the late Stephen Jay Gould now, from the American Museum in New York, to come up with a view that he calls punctuated equilibrium. How many people have heard of that? Okay, punctuated equilibrium basically argues that, okay, Colin Patterson is right, we have no fossils of transitional forms, but the reason for that is because they weren't fossilized. That transitional forms existed for only 20,000 to 100,000 years old, which if you give the evolutionists billions of years, that's only like a day or two. And so they didn't exist long enough to be fossilized, and they gave way to the next stage. So you would find like A, fossil of A and a fossil of C, but the transitional form B wasn't around long enough, didn't survive long enough to be fossilized. Now, right there, the Christians should, the creationists should cry foul. Because what Stephen Jay Gould is actually saying, well, what he should say is, well, if there's no fossils of transitional forms, then maybe there's no transitional forms. We're scientists. If there's no evidence for transitional forms, why should we believe in transitional forms? But what Stephen Jay Gould is saying is, I believe in evolution before I even examine the evidence. And since I believe in evolution, I assume it to be true, and there are no fossils of transitional forms, I'm going to accommodate my evolutionary model to fit the fact that there are no fossils of transitional forms. And it used to be called, earlier this in the last century, it used to be called the hopeful monster theory, where, you know, and proponents of it were made fun of, that, you know, people say, oh, yeah, what you're saying is two apes got together, had a baby boy and a baby girl, and enough baby boys and baby girls were born around the same time so that the human race started. So you'll have apes and you'll have humans, but you won't have any transitional forms because there were none. Well, no, these guys really aren't saying this, that. However, what they're saying is that whatever was between the apes and the humans existed for such a short time period that they didn't exist long enough to be fossilized. But again, you know, I think the creationists should cry foul and say, wait a minute, you're using the lack of evidence for evolution as if it's evidence for a different type of evolution, when in reality, the lack of evidence for evolution should be evidence, be considered evidence for creation, or evidence for the rejection of evolution. Okay? Yeah.
Well, I figure, how can you conceive billions of years if you can't conceive a God? That's, you know, billions of years as a human being is just, like, unfathomable.
Well, and here's why it's important. Dwayne Gish made this illustration that if you, I might have told it to you already, if a frog turns into a prince suddenly, okay, immediately, we call that a fairy tale. But if we say a frog turned into a prince gradually over a period of a few billion years, we call that good science. So keep in mind, if you're going to reject creationism, you know, apart from the Bible, just the idea of a creator God, creationism makes sense if you just have a few thousand years or if you have billions of years. Okay? Evolution only makes sense if you have, it almost only seems plausible if you give it billions of years. They have to have the billions of years.
If it was billions, it would just take 4 million years. Wouldn't we be digging up fossils and bones and, like, every 2 square feet?
Actually, it's actually the problem for evolution is actually the exact opposite of that. Given the rate of fossilization that occurs today, the rate of fossilization that's going on today, even if you had, you know, for the age of the universe, 15 to 18 billion years, you still would not have as much fossilization as we have today. So, the argument should be as follows. The creationist, the young Earth creationist, would argue as follows. Since even given billions of years with just regular processes and gradual evolution, that would not give you the amount of fossilization we have today. That tells us that the fossil record was not gradually produced over millions upon millions of years, but instead there had to be some kind of catastrophe or catastrophes that somehow produced this fossil record. But don't look for a process that's going on today, because there is no process going on today. The process of fossilization going on today is not producing enough fossils. In other words, the young Earth creationists would say the fossil graveyard, the fossil record, was produced rapidly by a worldwide flood. I saw one Christian who was a scientist who's being interviewed, and he said that they took, they wanted to take living things and kill them, you know, and stuff, and they they didn't feel like killing a dog and that type, a lot of dogs and stuff, so they just decided, well, we'll work with fish. And they were studying fossilization, and so they took a fish and they had it, after it was dead for a couple days, then they wrapped it in like something like cellophane or something to see if it would fossilize and wrapped it airtight. Well, it still decayed. So then they took a fish one day after its death and wrapped it up, and it still decayed. And even when they went down to just a couple minutes after the thing died and wrapped it up, and it still had some decay there. The only time in their experiment that they found that they can keep it from decaying was if they wrapped it while it was still alive. And so then the guy said that doesn't prove that all fossils were fossilized while they were alive, but it does argue that the evidence does indicate it would be much closer to that. You know, we know that to cause fossilization, you need rapid burial, something buried so rapidly that it doesn't have time to decay, and there's just no more air getting in there. But basically, that's one of the reasons why that guy started to leave the evolutionary camp and realize he needed to become a creationist, because the fossil record, it is much more plausible to accept the fossil record being caused by a global flood than by evolution. See, and then another problem with the fossil record is, you know, you got like different layers in the fossil record, different strata, and you go from the simple to the complex to the more complex to the most complex, you know. And you will see that frequently throughout the fossil record, but the fact of the matter is, there's more exceptions to that rule than there is that rule. So in other words, you might find that order from the simple to the complex being in higher layers and the more simple being in the lower layers, you'll find that more than any other, but it might be, you know, 35-40%. And then you'll have all these different, you know, put this one down here and that order might be 10%, and shuffle this around, that might be 5% or whatever. A major problem is the finding deep fossils of deep sea creatures, which here tend to be very simple, but fossils of deep sea creatures on every one of the highest mountain ranges on Earth today, which is evidence that every mountain range on Earth today was at one time deep under the ocean. Now, the evolutionists tried to explain that with upheavals in the Earth's crust and with you know, thousands upon thousands of different catastrophes all over the world. You could explain that all in, you know, one Occam's razor, one simple explanation, a global flood. And then, you know, Psalm 104 says God caused the mountains to rise and the valleys to sink. So we basically live on mountaintops that come out of the Earth and all. But what I'm getting at here is, if the fossil record was caused gradually over millions of years, in fact billions of years, then it's almost impossible to explain. I think it is impossible to explain in a plausible manner how they could be found out of order. I mean, if your argument is, well, look, this order proves evolution because it took millions of years for each of these layers to form, but then what do you do if something more simple is above something complex? You know, how do you explain that shuffling? And whereas with creationism, the reason why it's the order from the simple on the below and the complex on the top is because things were buried by the global flood in their habitat, okay? And then when you get to the more complex land animals, you know, they would start moving to higher ground until eventually the last to be caught would be man. But the creation model would also explain the exceptions to the rule by upheavals in the Earth's crust, which would be caused by a global flood. But with the evolutionary theory, I mean, it's real problematic to explain the differences. Another problem is that they have found polystrate fossils, like trees. You get a tree that goes through three or four different layers of the Earth's crust, and each of these layers supposedly took millions of years to be formed. Okay, the oldest trees we have on Earth today are the sequoias, and they're like 2,000 years old, some of them, and they're about 350 feet high. These layers, it's taken millions of years for these layers to be deposited. There's no way you're going to have a tree that lives millions of years. So again, that's a much easier explanation is the creation model says these layers were formed rapidly in the global flood, rather than saying it took millions of years for the layers to form, because then you're not going to be able to explain how the tree would survive that long. It's real circular reasoning. Now they'll use carbon-14 dating for dating of certain things, but even that is real subjective, because they'll get dates all over the place. But they think, based on their evolutionary research, they have an approximate date. So the date from the carbon-14 that comes out closest to what they've already guessed will go with that. But on this, there's a circular reasoning where if they find a fossil, okay, if they find a fossil, they will sometimes date the fossil based on the type of mineral that the layer is made up of. So in other words, sometimes they'll date the fossil by the layer that it's in, thinking that that by that layer they know the approximate age of that layer. But other times they'll date the layer by what type of fossils are there. So it's circular reasoning. So
that's what carbon-14 dating does too, on a broader scale.
Well, carbon-14 dating, a lot of problems with it. I think you could argue that except for exceptional cases, the Shroud of Turin being one, but except for exceptional cases, any carbon dating after the flood should be pretty accurate. But you get exceptional cases where there's something's occurred that goes against the assumptions that are made, such as rocks being formed by a volcano, that we know the rocks are only 100 years old and they've been dated to be billions of years old or millions of years old. So, yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, and that'd be interesting. Yeah. Yeah, the evolution assumes, you know, the whole idea of gradual change, they assume that the processes going on, like the processes of decay, processes that are going on today have been going on throughout all time at the same rate. So they assume that there were no global catastrophes. So by assuming that there's no global catastrophes, that means that evolution doesn't disprove the flood and doesn't disprove creation. It starts out by assuming creation is false and the flood is false. Because if you assume creation occurred and a global flood occurred, automatically evolutionary dating wouldn't work. Yeah, exactly. And after a global flood, the next thing to follow would be almost a complete global ice age. Yeah, and they want the global ice age, but they don't want the global flood. Every once in a while, you'll find evolutionists talking about all kinds of near global floods, but they never. You know, they try to. Well, we're talking about something, you know, billions of years ago. Nothing close to the time frame of the Bible. However, if their dating is off, I still think to this day that if you just realize that acknowledge that the global flood occurred, you have right there a simple explanation for the fossil record. And again, fossilization is so rare today that even given billions of years, we would not have the amount of fossilization that we have today with the same processes going on. So that tells us right off the bat there had to be at least one, if not many, catastrophes that somehow formed the fossil record. Fossilization necessitates rapid burial, and that's exactly what a flood does.
I understand that carbon-14 being part of the process of doing that is a theory in itself, therefore it's subject to a bunch of errors.
The thing is, for the most part, you know, there are assumptions that are made, but some of the assumptions are pretty safe. You come in this room, nobody's here, and there are these two books side by side, and they both have the same amount of dust on them. Okay? I think it's a pretty safe assumption that they probably were both placed on that desk or on that table at the same time. Okay? That's a safe assumption. It's not an infallible assumption, though. But how do we know that I didn't have this book, I left it here 2 weeks ago, okay? And so it gathered a week's worth of dust, and then last week I put this book beside it, but I dusted off this book. Okay? Yeah, but if I dusted that book off, and then a week later, they both have a week's amount of dust, so they look like they're the same age. But in actuality, one has been here twice as long as the other. And in other words, science goes by current processes, okay? But it assumes that there was no God to come in and dust things off. So if there's intervention, you know, divine intervention from outside the universe. If there was a global flood, to have that kind of water, 40 days and 40 nights worth of water to cover every mountaintop under heaven, to have that kind of water in the surrounding the Earth's atmosphere would create some, there would be the climatic differences of a pre-flood world would be so drastic. I mean, you know, the ozone layer. Everybody's concerned about the ozone layer because it filters some of the poisonous rays of the sun. So you can actually, you can get premature wrinkles if you stay out in the sun too long. And so, you know, part of the aging process is genetics, but another part also deals with the poisonous rays of the sun. So if you had 40 days and 40 nights worth of water surrounding the Earth's atmosphere in between the Earth and the Sun, that would filter out so many more of these poisonous rays of the Sun. It would slow down the aging process in man. So it's not a coincidence that we see guys living to be over 900 years before the flood and then taking a nosedive right after the flood. Okay? Also, you'd have reptiles. Reptiles grow till the day they die. So what would happen if you had crocodiles living, 10 times as long? Right now we've got some crocodiles 20 feet long in off the coast of Australia. You know, if they live 10 times as long, they're going to be a lot bigger than 20 feet long. So, But and that's another thing too, is that there is some strong evidence that some quote unquote dinosaurs still exist today. The coelacanth, we found that. So everybody agrees, okay, we thought it was extinct for millions of years and it's still alive. But off the coast of New Zealand, a Japanese fishing boat reeled in what appeared to be, from the photograph that was taken, a freshly decayed plesiosaur. And it can't be just one. So there would have to be more. But you also have in the Congo tribal peoples talking about some kind of monster and all, and then when showed just different photos, the different drawings of make-believe monsters, they pointed out what we used to call the Brontosaurus. They identified that, but it was like a drawing of a man next to it, the scale, and they said, well, it's a lot smaller now. But then they said too, it won't eat people, but it will stomp them to death. And these guys never had a course in evolution. So there's some evidence. The existence of quote unquote dragons, some large lizard-like creatures that would torment people. Paintings of them, not just on cave walls, but even in medieval times. So I think there's some really good evidence up there for even dinosaurs either still existing or at least existing after the flood, probably dying out because dinosaurs are like 98% plant eaters, and the vegetation without that canopy of water around the Earth's atmosphere, you're not going to get as much wholesome vegetation as you would have had before. Before the flood, it would have been more of a kind of the perfect greenhouse or tropical environment all over the globe. But whatever the case, on this note, transitional forms, the evolutionist argues that reptiles evolved into birds. Okay? We now know that reptiles have a totally different type of design for their lungs than birds do. Okay? One is like tubes, and the other is like sacs or something, but it's a totally different design. And lungs, like most organs, do not work unless they're fully developed. In other words, you have the breathing apparatus. Whatever would have been between the reptiles and the birds, the transitional form, would have had a breathing apparatus that does not work. How could it exist for, even if Stephen Jay Gould is right, how could it exist for 20 to 100,000 years as a species long enough to evolve into birds? Now, by the way, this was one of the things that Darwin said in his Origin of Species. There are certain things that, if proven, would disprove my thesis. And this is one of them. If you can prove any gap that could not occur, and any jump that could not be made from, point A to point B. The same can be said about fish gills to lungs. Archaeopteryx was supposed to be, the transitional form between reptiles and birds, and now that's been rejected because it's got some features like reptiles, some like birds, but it's been rejected now almost universally by evolutionary scientists because every reptilian feature found in Archaeopteryx is also found in some bird. In other words, like the ostriches have claws, and certain birds have teeth. And so you could find, you can't find all the reptilian features of Archaeopteryx in one bird, but you could find one in this bird, one in another bird, And eventually you can find every feature that Archaeopteryx has, every reptilian feature in somewhere in the bird family. Also, it was supposed to be the transitional form. Now they found fossils of birds that are older than Archaeopteryx. So they acknowledge, okay, well then it couldn't have been the transitional form, because here you have stuff, birds that existed before it existed. And so right now Archaeopteryx has been classified as just a bird. A weird bird, but just as a bird. And only in college textbooks, which take about a generation or two to get edited, only in college textbooks do you find Archaeopteryx still promoted as a transitional form. The transitional forms between apes and men, there's no undisputed. Even though when you look, you open up a college textbook and you start out with a little monkey and it turns into this big gorilla, and then all of a sudden at the end, by the time you get to the end of the page, you got a naked guy, naked human being walking off the end of the page. Every one of those transitional forms, there is no undisputed transitional form. Like Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon man, they bear the features of modern man. Our skulls could be classified, you know, some of us as Neanderthal, some of us as Cro-Magnon. Most of the skulls turned out to be extinct apes, skulls of extinct apes, okay? Some are so bad that, how many people saw Inherit the Wind with Spencer Tracy about the monkey trial? It was the 1925 Scopes trial, and a high school teacher got in trouble for teaching evolution in school. Back then, you could only teach creation in schools. And so he wanted to teach evolution and creation. And so he got in trouble, so the ACLU came to his defense and said you should be able to teach both. But during that trial, they made a movie about it in the 1950s. The lawyer from the ACLU goes before the Bible believer and holds up a tooth and says, you know what this tooth is? And the Bible believer says, no, I don't. So this tooth. Scientists found this tooth, and then from this tooth, they constructed a skull and a skeleton. And he didn't tell them, it was all by their imagination. And then an entire race of missing links between apes and men. And this tooth is the evidence of it. And, you know, the Bible believer was shocked, the people were shocked in the courtroom. This is a 1950s movie based on a 1925 trial. So the movie could have told you, but the producers decided not to tell you that 2 years after that trial, the same scientists found more of those teeth in that same general area. But they also found more bones and some skulls, and they found the tooth was that of an extinct pig. Okay? So there's an awful lot of imagination. Sometimes just a portion of a skull, and it turns out to be, a member of of a horse family. I'm not sure if it was Nebraska man. Turned out to be a member of the horse family, and we've got that still in college textbooks and high school textbooks listed as one of the missing links. Okay, so there is no undisputed missing link. They recently proposed some newer one, and now Chuck Colson came out with it that most evolutionary scientists are acknowledging it's just the skull of an extinct ape. So whatever the case, but I mean, you could, just like Norman Geisler said, you could take cars and line up cars that look a little bit like each other, and then argue that that car evolved into the car on one end of the room evolved into the car on the other end of the room, when in actuality it's just your imagination based on the similarities. And so both the creationist and the evolutionist would agree concerning human anatomy.
That's right.
Nope. I can't pronounce it. Okay. Common anatomy, you know, the arm of a man, the fin of a shark, the wing of a bird, we all agree that that there's some commonalities there. But that doesn't automatically mean common ancestry, okay? Because it could mean common designer. Okay? So, in reality, creation and evolution are not really scientific theories. If we use a theory in a precise scientific manner, and most, by the way, most scientists don't, a scientific theory is the end of the scientific method. And the scientific method begins with observation of some ongoing observable process, and then you end, you may take it out.